And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our former chancellor and our neighbor, James Meeser, has gained international recognition as an organist, as a concert organist, and as a scholar and teacher. And he has a specialization in Bach, in Johann Sebastian Bach, in his sacred music and the organ pieces, and then in what it is that Bach is trying to do with his music as it relates to spirituality or theology and how all that fits together. And Dr. Meeser is going to be sharing that with folks at the Friday Center on the evenings of March 6th and 7th from 7 to 9 p.m. on each day. It's free, but you got to sign up for it.
It's not free. It's actually a $50 enrollment fee. Which actually then gets a person who enrolls into one of the two concerts that the Amsterdam Baroque Choir.
So it's buying a ticket, and then it's free.
That's right. Yeah. So it's actually, these lectures are in anticipation of two concerts in Memorial Hall on March 13 and 14 by the Amsterdam Baroque Choir and Orchestra. This is the preeminent early music group in the world coming to Chapel Hill to perform on March the 13th. They're going to perform what I regard the most important work in Western music, the B minor Mass of Johann Sebastian Bach. And on the next night, on the 14th, they're going to perform another fabulous piece, Bach's Magnificat in D major, and two Bach cantatas. So in two evenings, we're going to hear just an incredible performance by this preeminent group coming to Chapel Hill. So that's why I'm doing these lectures at the Friday
Center.
You're
excited.
A week early.
Most of us would just say, well, this is another one of Emil Kang's great gets that he's bringing to us. But it's special for you because you love Bach, and here he is bringing what you say and what you believe is one of the most important, if not the most important.
If you were going to list, D.G., sort of the great marvels of Western culture, you'd probably list the Pietà and maybe St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome.
Oh, come on. And it's in that category.
The B minor Mass would be in that list.
And just disregarding all of the accomplishments of Beethoven, of Wagner, this is...
And the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven would be in that list as well. I mean, it's...
Oh, okay.
Right.
This is...
It's a monumental work.
Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, his sort of final, his last symphony, and maybe his send-off, his goodbye to us in the... And that's his best.
Well, that's what Bach was doing with the BM. Bach was doing a number of things, but this work, and we don't really know because this is all musical scholarship that's still being uncovered. But we do know that the very end of this Mass may have been the last notes that Bach put on paper before he went blind. Beethoven went deaf, Bach went blind.
Well, I don't want to. I guess we can't get off topic, but putting this in historical context, I guess one of the questions that you've raised and will answer in your lecture is why is this Protestant, deeply Protestant, in a Germany which the ruling princes were taking up sides? And you better be on the right side.
Right.
And he's out in northeastern Germany.
Central Germany,
in the Protestant.
In the heavily Protestant sector.
Yeah, now what's going on?
Okay, it's a really interesting story. In 1723, Bach was appointed the cantor of the Thomaskirche in Leipzig. Leipzig was the intellectual heart of Germany. The greatest university was in Leipzig. Was Germany's college town, if you will, in the 18th century. And it was also a cultural center and an economic center. They had a big trade fair. So it was a very cosmopolitan, very prosperous, and well-educated place.
It was the
capital of Saxony, and it was the most
not
actually,
far from where Luther.
Not Württemberg, not very far
but
at all.
But not far, yeah.
Heavily Lutheran, right. And as a matter of fact, interestingly enough, the position of music director of the church, the principal, actually there were four big Lutheran churches in Leipzig. The Thomas Kirche was one, the Nikolai Kirche just a few blocks away. There was another one called the Neue Kirche. They were all Lutheran, and they were all governed by the town council. And Bach was actually elected, if you will, by the town council. This is a municipal position. Well, there's no separation of church and state, obviously.
The town leaders have their church. You know, the church and the town are all together.
It's all one. And his duties included not only preparing the music of the Thomas Kirche and the Nikolai Kirche, teaching in the church school, the city school, and in the university. He was also he had municipal wide responsibilities. Okay, so to your question, in 1733, 10 years after he arrived in Leipzig, Bach decided he wanted a royal appointment. He was beginning to have some trouble with the town council, and he wanted a charter from the elector, who was in Dresden. Now the elector,
I just think this is so funny because I put Bach as a star on your faculty,
yeah.
Who is great. There's no question about it. But he's getting a little bit antsy because he is so good, and they won't. The chancellor won't give him everything he asked for. Not a new office. He won't give him a secretary. He won't give him a parking place or basketball ticket.
One of the attractions to Leipzig when he first went was the fact that he didn't have to work for a monarch anymore. He could work for this elected town council. But as we all know, councils come and councils go. And 10 years later, he was dealing with a bunch of not
people
very—
people who didn't hire him.
That's
yeah.
right. Who didn't hire him, who didn't value him, and a really hard time. And he was getting into scrapes and political tussles, and so he said, "I need a little more clout." So he composed this piece. Now I have to go back. The elector of Saxony, the court was actually in Dresden. That was the royal center. The elector had converted to Roman Catholicism so that he could be anointed king of Poland.
This is a little bit complicated in the sense that the Poles weren't like the people to the west in the sense. I think they elected their king, didn't they?
Well,
you had to be a Catholic.
You had to be a Catholic.
And elected by the princes.
I don't know as much about Poland as I know about Germany, but I really can't answer that.
But
question.
In order to rule Poland, this neighboring German
Protestant
converted
elector,
like Henry in France.
Who, it was this the elector Frederick.
A mass is yeah, out the
exactly.
a mass.
No, this was done. Actually, not uncommon. Dresden becomes a very interesting place. The royal chapel in Dresden is a Roman Catholic chapel in a heavily Protestant city. And in fact, Christoph Wolff, who is the best Bach scholar now living, says that Dresden was this sort of Catholic, Roman Catholic diaspora in the heart of Lutheran Germany. And in fact, all the other churches in Dresden remained Protestant, but the court itself was Catholic. By the way, the elector's wife never converted. She remained staunchly Lutheran to her grave. And in fact, Bach composed a Trauerode, and her service was actually in Leipzig because she refused to convert. In fact, they hid the fact that the children had been baptized in the Roman Catholic Church until sometime later because it was highly controversial and not popular at all. I mean, he was not beloved at home but he did this in order to become king of Poland. Okay, so Bach decides he wants this royal. So what does he do? He writes the Misa of 1733, which is this, and he writes this incredibly florid letter to. I didn't bring it with me, but I'm going to. I'll read this lecture, this letter that Bach writes.
It sounds like this letter. I've got it somewhere, but
I sent it to
sounded
you,
like the biggest guy sucking up.
Oh, it was
king,
a real suck up.
It just turned you off.
Yeah, it was so incredible. The groveling that right. subjects did to get royal attention. And by the way, he sent this piece to Dresden. It was only the first two movements of what we now know as the B minor mass, the Kyrie and the Gloria. We don't know if it was performed, but he sent it. And he didn't get his royal charter until 3 years later.
What did the royal charter do for him?
It just gave him a little more status back home it appointed him the Kapellmeister.
I see.
It gave him a title, and it gave him some authority to say to the town council. I'm the Kapellmeister, an appointment by the elector.
And some money? Did the
No, I don't think it was any money. It was more
honorary.
It was power, leverage. So he may have also sent the Magnificat, by the way. Now, I have to say two things about all of this. There's still no contradiction in this. By the way, the Kyrie and the Gloria were still sung in the Lutheran churches in Latin.
Really?
So Latin was not by any means verboten in the Lutheran service. And this part, what we call the Misa, these first two movements, could have been sung in the service in Leipzig. We don't think they were. But Luther was not at all against Latin. He just wanted the service to be understood. And Leipzig being a university town, everybody understood Latin.
So it was a mass that would be acceptable at least for Protestant Lutherans.
Yes.
As a part of it would work either way as the great kind of
right.
Religious. You don't think of that in today's time that you could import a mass into virtually any Protestant church except a high Episcopal church.
Well, of course, that's true. But the Kyrie and the Gloria were still sung. They were sung either in Latin or in German. And on high festival days in Leipzig and in other big Lutheran centers, there would be concerted works in Latin. So that
and
was
were the words fixed? The words that were part of the Bach's music is accompanying. These are fixed words from
right.
Latin Mass.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So you didn't have to find somebody to write the words.
No. And of course, the Magnificat, which is all in D major, also in 1733, Latin text, and that's the "My soul doth magnify the Lord," the Song of Mary from Luke. Which the Romans used in their service of Vespers when that was taken right over into the Lutheran Vesper service and still sung in Latin or in German. And just as the English adapted Evensong from Roman Catholic Vespers, and the Magnificat is still there. And so much of the liturgy of certainly the Lutheran Church as we know it today and the Church of England and the Episcopal Church grows right out of the Roman liturgy. Now, where it differs is that in the Lutheran service, they didn't sing so much in the service. The last three movements of the Mass, which hadn't been written yet by Bach, the Sanctus, the Credo, the Sanctus, and the Agnus Dei. And that's another interesting story because he gives this submission in 1733. It's not until the last 2 years of his life. He died in 1750. About 1748, he takes this up again.
So he wrote the first. This is. I tell you what. We need to take a break, and okay. Let me come back and I want to keep on this topic.
Right.
I'm visiting with James Meiser, and we're talking about Bach, and it's all in the context of a series of two lectures that Chancellor Meiser will present on March 6th and March 7th at the Friday Center. All that in preparation for the concerts the following week on the 13th and 14th at Memorial Hall. We'll talk more about all of that after this short break.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with former Chancellor James Meiser. We're talking about Bach, and it's all in the context of an upcoming, really, Bach Festival in Chapel Hill beginning on March 6th and 7th when Chancellor Meiser will be talking about the works that will be performed the following week, and we'll talk more about that and how you can get your tickets. But I interrupted this great story about the composition of what Chancellor Meiser earlier said is one of the four or five greatest significant artistic pieces in Western civilization, and this is the B minor Mass from Bach, and he composed part of it. Help me if I got this.
Okay, let's go back. 1733 is the Misa. The Misa really refers to the first two movements. This is a technical term. The Misa mm-hmm. really represents just the first two movements of the five-movement Mass, so the Kyrie Eleison and the Gloria in Excelsis. And that was submitted, and as we said earlier, that could have been – and by the way, that was still – the Misa was still sung in the Lutheran service. It's both Protestant and Catholic.
Now, he sent that to the king sort of as, this is what I can do, and give me a charter. Give me an appointment.
Exactly. This is my – it was a musical offering, if you will. Late in life, Bach begins, and this is interesting also in the sense that in the last 10 years of Bach's life, he's still in Leipzig, musical taste is already evolving in Europe. Bach's sons he had many sons, many of whom were accomplished musicians. Bach's compositional style is already, by the last 10 years of his life, is regarded as hopelessly old-fashioned and not in mode. The emerging classical period, what we know as ultimately Haydn and Mozart, the late 18th century, is already in its early stages. And Bach's music, he's regarded as the old Whig in Leipzig, the old Bach, and he's really known in his late life. He's still recognized as a fabulous organist. No one could touch him as a performer. He was an incredible performer on the organ. In fact, he had competitions with Louis Marchand, who came from France, heard Bach play, and actually fled. wouldn't even attempt to compete with Bach. I mean, so that was his reputation. But he was regarded as hopelessly old-fashioned and almost forgotten. By the way, none of this music that we're talking about was published in his time, and much of it was lost. And in fact, it's almost a miracle that we have this work. The first two movements, the Misa, of course, were submitted there was a copy in Dresden of that submission. The last three movements, as I said, he started work on in the last 2 years of his life. Why? We don't really know, except that we know that he was all about sort of wrapping up his contribution to posterity. I think he was thinking about posterity. He knew that he was losing his eyesight. There were a number of pieces. The Art of Fugue, for example, this great contrapuntal work that he wrote that was sort of abstract music. It was sort of like Beethoven's. There are really lots of similarities to Beethoven in the late quartets. And the Mass is similar. By the way, there was never from Bach anything to say B minor Mass. There was no.
This is our term, or this is a modern term.
This is a term that's been put on it in the 19th century.
And so, just to be clear, what did he call it?
He didn't call it. He actually called it four things. He called it Misa, which was the first two movements. Then the second movement was called Symbolum Nicenum, which is Latin for Nicene Creed. The third movement was called Sanctus. And the fourth movement was actually, and again here, this is where it doesn't really comport with the Roman Catholic Mass, because he sort of mushed together the Agnus Dei, the Hosanna, which really belongs with the Sanctus and Benedictus, and he wrote a separate movement called Dona Nobis Pacem, Grant Us Thy Peace, which is actually a literal recapitulation of something that occurred way back in the Gloria in Excelsis. There were sort of in four folders, and this was all bound together. But we know that he intended it as a single work, because at the end of all of his pieces, all of his major works, he always wrote three letters, S-D-G. That's Bach's sign-off. Soli Deo Gloria. To God alone be glory. That was his.
That's sort of his the end.
That is the end. That's for him. That's the end. So we know that he conceived this as a whole. It was almost certainly never performed in his lifetime. In fact, there's not even evidence that the first piece that was submitted to Dresden was ever performed. It may have been there because there are performance parts that he actually marked up. So I actually have a hunch that it probably was performed once.
James Meester, as he wrote the score for these pieces, mm-hmm. and he was an organist,
right?
So surely tried out. You know, did he listen to it? That he would
not necessarily.
He would, you could write it. I mean, you musicians, you can write this stuff down.
Absolutely.
And say, I hear this in my head.
Oh yeah,
I can just
remember Beethoven was deaf when he wrote August Latin.
I know, but I mean, you would never write anything without kind of punching it out.
Well, I'm not Bach.
No, but you're.
No, good composers. Mozart did too. Mozart. A composer doesn't need to hear music to write it on paper. I mean, he can hear it in his inner ear.
This is the work which you earlier said is just the high point of Western music.
Right.
And that that perhaps during the lifetime of the composer probably was never played.
Almost certainly. It almost certainly was never played. In fact, I'm absolutely certain that the last three movements were never performed.
But
DG, Why? How could this be? In almost every case, this is also interesting. This music was a reworking of earlier music that he had written that had been performed.
This is a great point, and let's take a break early and come back and talk about how much of this was original.
Okay.
And we're visiting with James Meeser. We're talking about Bach, and it's in the context of Dr. Meeser's talks that we'll talk more about in the next section. But in case you got to turn off the radio now, you're pulling in the driveway, don't miss his lectures on March 6th and 7th. Or the performances of Bach's pieces the following week at Memorial Hall. Dr. Meeser and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is James Meeser, our former chancellor, and, as we are learning, incredible and interesting expert on music, and particularly with respect to Bach. We're talking about the compositions that we're going to have the opportunity to hear in the middle of March at Memorial Hall, and then have the opportunity to hear about in the first week in March with your lectures at Memorial Hall. But one of the interesting from the preview of your talk that you gave me is that Bach, we're talking about these great compositions.
Right.
But the thing that always fascinated me about Bach was that every Sunday he didn't go to the hymn book and get a piece. Well, maybe he did, but what he did, he assembled a piece of music specially for that
right.
Sunday.
He actually did go to the hymn book. He went to the hymn book, picked out a chorale, a hymn, and then wrote a 25-minute cantata, which he then had to teach to the choir. And by the way, think about these forces he had at Thomaskirche. He had an orchestra, and he had a choir school with boys, and so he had an SATB choir with boy sopranos, and he taught in the school every day, and so he composed the cantata, wrote out the parts, taught it to the choir, rehearsed the orchestra, and performed it on Sunday.
Now,
and he did this
almost every week.
Every week. He did over a period in his first 5 years in Leipzig. And this is just an incredible thing. He composed approximately 300 church cantatas. These are 25-minute works. None of these cantatas, by the way, were published in Bach's time. None of them. They were all manuscripts. After his death, Bach's whole library was distributed among his sons and children. He had 22 children by two wives. A number of them died early, so they didn't all survive, but there were a number of surviving children. In addition to these 300 cantatas, and we're talking just about the first 5 years, from 1723 to 1728-29, 300 cantatas, the Magnificat that we're going to also hear in this period, a big Sanctus, the Trauer Ode that he wrote for the widow of the elector who remained Protestant, the St. Matthew Passion, the St. John Passion, these are enormous works, and the Christmas Oratorio. If Bach had been an operatic composer, and you took all these hours of music, he would have written the equivalent of about 35 operas. 35 operas.
All of this is just socks me upside the head because, write a column every week.
Right.
Well, a column's easy to write because it's all yours and you get it and you spit it out and it's gone in 600 words. But doing something every week and have it be fresh and new and this is a musical production. This is like writing a musical and
exactly.
Producing it
now,
every
so
week.
How important, okay, so it's a lot of stuff, right? So we can agree on that, a huge amount of quantity. But how good was it? Let me read you this. This is Christoph Wolff, who's at Harvard University, the leading Bach scholar, writing this one paragraph. To the question, how important is this music? He writes, "It is difficult to gain a true idea of the sheer scale of Bach's achievement, still less of the aesthetic value of these cantatas, but it is worth recalling that even the surviving corpus of around 180 works, because many of them were lost, 180 works represents some 75 hours of music, with an average 25 minutes per work. In other words, these cantatas are the equivalent of 25 three-hour operas. There are few composers who can boast such an output. Not that mere quantity, of course, says anything about the artistic merits of the music. Indeed, and this is the key sentence, indeed, it is the uniformly high quality of Bach's cantatas that constitutes one of the most astonishing aspects of the Leipzig Thomas Cantor's musical personality. Mm-hmm. Now, so this, that's just a stunning musical achievement. That goes on for about 5 or 6 years in his first period in Leipzig. Then he gets interested in other things. By the way, by now he's got this huge library of 300 cantatas that still he's performing every week, but he turns his compositional interests elsewhere, starts writing.
So he starts recycling for his regular work. He goes back to his library and says, y'all forgot that we did this 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so he has a library of stuff. And by the way, when he walked into this post in Leipzig, his predecessor said none of them had ever done this before. They'd always performed other people's music. But Bach put his own personal stamp on that church and that institution, of course, left us this. Now, the tragedy of all this, of course, is as I said, after Bach died, these manuscripts were handed out to his children. Some of them were actually wrapped around trees to help in the German winter to keep them from freezing, and some of them were just thrown away. This is old music. This is the old Bach. So only about 180 out of 300, three-fifths of them were retained.
Still, when you think about it, pretty good that we're fortunate to have.
Now the rest of the story, and this takes us back to the B minor Mass.
Now, so, for anybody who joined us late, we're really talking about, we've been talking about mostly the B minor Mass, which James Meiser says is a highlight of Western culture and Western art. And that's, we're going to hear that in Chapel Hill, and we're going to hear you talk about that at the Friday Center. But where we started with all of this is maybe not all of the music for the B minor Mass was brand new original.
Almost none of it was, in fact. Bach was a master of parody. A parody technique, which is taking pre-existent material and reshaping it, repurposing it, recycling it. He recycled his own material, by the way, and this was a highly valued technique in the 18th century. Handel did the same thing. If you look at Handel's output, a chorus in Messiah might have earlier been something in a secular opera that Handel had written, and Bach did the same thing. Bach wrote secular cantatas as well as sacred cantatas, and in the Mass, for example, in the very second, the Christe Eleison, which is this sort of a almost like a love aria. Bach used these operatic arias. He brought them. He used them in both Magnificat and in the Mass.
Now, were these his or were these other people's?
Oh no, they were his. They were his. He was recycling his own material. He was. By the way, he copied out lots of other people's music as well. He wrote organ concertos based on Vivaldi, Concerti Grossi. But he never hid the fact that it was Vivaldi. He said after Vivaldi, so he gave Vivaldi credit for it. But one of the ways that Bach mastered compositional style was to copy out the music of other composers. He copied out, for example, he learned how to write for the Roman Catholic Mass. He copied Palestrina. He copied it out in its entirety, and then
you say these composers, they can feel the music as they.
He copied out scores in the sense of dozens of other composers to learn their technique, and that was he would how do you figure out how Louis Couperin writes music in France? Well, you write out his music, and so he wrote out lots of French music.
Like an aspiring artist would go to a museum and try to recreate a master.
Exactly.
You send
art students to the museum to copy the Mona Lisa, or to copy Degas or Monet. I mean, it is one of the classical ways of learning the art of composition is to learn what, in one sense Bach. Bach mastered the compositional styles of all of the old masters, and the 18th century is interesting in that there is a very clear Italian style. I mean, Handel went to Italy to learn the Italian style. Bach never went to Italy. He just copied out Vivaldi and the other Italian masters. Bach never went to France. But Bach completely mastered the French style, and he wrote in it. He wrote pieces which we regard as fully French because he understood the French style. And that's another thing in a sense that makes him such a master, because he was both the two great giants of the Baroque era are Bach and Handel. In fact, I'm starting out my lecture comparison.
I tell you what, let's take a break, and then I want you to tell the story or answer the question of did Bach and Handel ever meet, and if they did, what did they say to each other?
Right.
We'll be right back visiting with former Chancellor James Meiser. We're talking about Bach.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is James Meiser. We're talking about Johann Sebastian Bach, and we're talking about him in the context of really a Bach celebration that's going to take place, or that is taking place really as we speak here in Chapel Hill, getting ready for Dr. Meiser's two lectures on March 6th and 7th at the Friday Center, preparing us for two concerts the following week, including one performance of the highlight of Western music, what we call the B minor mass. And part of your lecture, you gave me an advanced copy of it, but one of the interesting things is those of us who are not really musicians, we have, you know, Mozart, Beethoven, Handel, Bach. If you ask us to where they fit with each other, right, it's kind of hard to put. But Bach and Handel were contemporaries. Did they ever meet?
They were absolute contemporaries. It's a very interesting story. And by the way, when we think about the whole span of music history, sometimes in music history you can say the Baroque period ended between 1750 and 1759. How do we know that? Bach died in 1750. Handel died in 1759. They were both born in 1685, so they lived almost identical lifespans. Handel was born in Halle.
All in Germany,
70 miles from Bach's birthplace in Eisenach. 70 miles. They never met. Handel traveled.
I mean, these are, at least in currently, these are icons of the Baroque period.
One of the most important. They are clearly the summative figures of the
period.
They were contemporaries.
They never come close to meeting.
They did come close to meeting twice, actually. And we don't know how much Handel wanted to meet Bach, but we know very much Bach wanted to meet Handel.
Why not?
Well, Handel was much more famous, by the way, in their time. If you went to Berlin in 1745 and said, "Who are the most famous musicians, German musicians or German born?" you would have probably been told Handel and Telemann. Telemann was more famous than Bach. In fact, Telemann was the first choice for Leipzig for the Thomas.
Oh, that's Kirchner. Another story. That's
and there was a guy named Graupner who was the second choice. Bach was actually the third choice. I say in my lecture, this is one of the classic examples of the failures of search committees. They sort of backed into getting
they
Bach.
They were lucky.
They were lucky. Yeah. That's right. In fact, they wrote, "Sometimes you just have to settle for the mediocre candidate."
And so Bach was the mediocre candidate.
That's right.
Who got
so back to Bach and Handel. They never met. Bach was visiting Halle, and he heard that Handel was back home. Handel, you know, went to England, became an English subject, and was celebrated in England. Of course, we know him for Messiah and all of the great oratorios, especially and operas that Handel wrote in London. And Handel was a celebrated figure.
I mean, you like him.
Oh, I love Handel.
Yeah,
I don't mean to denigrate Handel. I love Handel. I love Telemann, too, by the way. Telemann is not a shabby composer. He's just not the...
It's like the Mozart and Salieri that we saw the film, so we think Salieri's... But he's a great composer. So these are all great people. It's just that in this case, Bach shines.
That's right. Bach went to Halle. He heard that Handel was in town, and he went to Handel's house only to learn that Handel had left that day. He missed him by just a few hours. He invited Handel to come to Leipzig, and Handel never replied. It's kind of a sad note that Handel, And they were, in many ways, they're opposites. Handel was this debonair. I suspect Handel may have been gay. Handel was never married. He was dashing. If you go to London, you can go to the Handel House. You can see the room where Handel wrote some harpsichord concertos. And I grew up loving Handel, and I still love Handel. But I must say, when I went to Leipzig and saw the statue of Bach, it was moving. Because for me, it is just such incredibly powerful music, and if it's powerful for me because Bach, he embodies the Reformation. He embodies very devout. And by the way, Luther, Handel was also devout. I don't question Luther's spirituality for a moment, but Bach, in my view, was deeper. And more profound, and therefore this music is incredibly moving.
We've talked about the B minor Mass a lot. I'm not enough,
right.
But a lot. And you're also going to give a talk on some of Bach's other music.
Well, the second night, the second night, people should not, just because the Mass is so great, the Magnificat is an incredibly wonderful work. And then we're going to hear two Bach cantatas, the second one of which, by the way, has two movements of probably the single best-known work of Bach. And if I say, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, everybody knows that. Every bride's mother has been seated to that music
transcription. This is the wedding. I shouldn't interrupt you because you got such little time, but I went through our little hymn book and found a lot of Bach, but not much Bach that I knew. All of the Bach was Bach had recreated somebody else's, but I said, what is the Bach music that we really know? And it is this, Yes, Joy from Wedding.
This is Cantata 147. We're going to hear that on March the 14th. And actually, you'll hear it twice. The cantata's in two parts. And I want to just say a quick word about the cantatas because this maybe we'll end with this. This is where Bach, the Lutheran church musician, really show how his work. He wrote these cantatas. I would say they are as important in the Sunday service as the sermon, and they're all built around whatever the gospel lesson was for that day. So if he wrote something for the 13th Sunday after Trinity, the preacher was expected to preach on that text, and Bach's cantata is a reflection on that text. It is absolutely about whatever the gospel message is for that Sunday. Every one of those cantatas is related. They're all written for a specific Sunday based on what are the lectionary readings were for that day. And by the way, they were interspersed into the service. So you'd have the first movement of the cantata, then the Old Testament lesson, then a part of the cantata, then the epistle, the cantata and the gospel, the cantata. And then after the sermon, you'd probably hear the last movement of the cantatas. This is pure church music. And this was Bach's. And what a contribution to the whole world that this is. Beyond the Lutheran Church, because we still have this body of work, which is really, in many ways, these are sermons, these cantatas.
Well, they're sermons if you know what you're talking about, as you do, and as you'll be explaining in your lectures to us. But how does Bach's music fit liturgically now? But the cantatas, as you just pointed out, these are meant to be 30 minutes worth of music for a service. Now, we've got two or three hymns.
These Leipzig Lutherans, DG, went to church for about 4 hours on Sunday. Let's face it, the Sunday service was a huge event in the cultural life of that. And so, yes, we live in a totally different time. And I think we understand this music today more if it's performed, they're still performed in church, but they're usually done in more of a concert environment than a liturgical environment. And that's because let's face it, an hour and a half service is about the length of our attention span.
Yeah, well,
and most in many Protestants, 61 minutes is over the edge.
It's 59 and a half minutes. I'm getting out of my area of expertise, and only a quick check in the hymn book, and that. But the point is that Bach in the short hymn book is not overly represented in our churches.
If you look at a Lutheran hymnal, you obviously see a lot more. But Lutherans, by the way, will tell you that Bach in some conservative Lutherans will say that Bach actually corrupted the cantata because he recast their hymns. The original Lutheran hymns were very, very rhythmical and jagged and with all kinds of irregular rhythms, and Bach smoothed them out and made them choral pieces. They're called and so Bach's chorales are really choral adaptations of Lutheran hymns. So in the Presbyterian hymnal, which you know, and the 1982 Episcopal hymnal, we have mostly Bach's harmonizations of Lutheran. But if you look at a Lutheran hymnal, especially a Lutheran Missouri Synod hymnal, which is the German branch of the Lutheran Church in this country, you'll see the chorales in their more original form. When I went to Germany as a student and went to services in Lutheran services, I was amazed by the muscular, rhythmic vitality of these Lutheran hymns. Luther, you remember Luther's famous statement that the devil shouldn't have all the good tunes. O Sacred Head Now Wounded is really O Flora Minor Vita with you, and it was a dance tune. It was a dance hall saloon tune.
Well, we're just getting started, Chancellor Mieser, about Bach, and I'm looking forward to your two talks on March 6th and March 7th.
Right. And don't forget Bach. The concerts on March 13 and 14 in Memorial Hall.
Memorial Hall. A great Bach celebration.
And I should say also, DG, right beforehand, I'll do an hour before each of those concerts in Girard Hall to do a brief 30-minute talk before each of them for anybody who's going to the concert.
For the performances, that's wide open, and that's don't have to register. Just
that's
show up
right.
a little bit
just
early for the concerts. Chancellor Mieser, thanks so much. This has been great.
Thanks, DG.
And thanks all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.